are out of executive session, and we will table the issue discussed in executive session until later in this meeting, because we have a timed item right now that we must do. And as noted at the beginning of the meeting, we can stop discussion and move forward. So at this point in time, I'm going to move to agenda item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to an initial case review. Again, a reminder for the board that members here that the purpose of this initial review is to determine whether or not there may be a violation of rule or statute. The board may vote to go into executive session again on any item pursuant to ARS 38-431-03-A2 to review confidential records, or ARS 38-431-03-A3 to receive confidential legal advice from our attorney. Individuals who wish to speak must complete a request to speak form and provide it to a board staff member, and you will be provided an opportunity to address the board. Agenda item 7A is complaint number 1905 pertaining to Dr. Farr. Are there any board members here who are recusing from this case? None. Thank you. Ms. Shreve, you are the lead board member for this agenda item. Would you please provide the board with a factual overview of the case?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. The complainant SD, states that she had been seeing Dr. Farr for approximately 3 years. SD believed that Dr. Farr had not provided any tools to better herself. Also, she claims that in an appointment in January 2019, SD told Dr. Farr that she didn't want to leave home because she was feeling ugly and worthless, and that she says that Dr. Farr responded saying, "Well, you're getting a little chunky." SD told Dr. Farr that the comment wasn't very nice and alleges that Dr. Farr responded, "Well, some guys like that." Dr. Farr responded in a timely manner. He states that he's been treating the patient since October 2016. The patient had attended 22 sessions over about a 2.5-year period. That within the first 3 months that she was very engaged, but then abandoned treatment but came back. Feels that the patient had a difficulty understanding the psychotherapy, that is a process, and that the therapist-patient relationship is a primary tool to facilitate patient's growth. Client stated that he never responded to SD in the way that she alleged in the complaint, that the complainant never stated that she felt ugly or worthless, however possibly that she feels that way. That the client was extremely upset on the January 28th, 2019 session, but the last session, according to Dr. Farr, was on February 4th, 2019. The complaint review committee reviewed this complaint and determined that there was a possible violation of ARS 32-2061-16-0 for possibly providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities of a psychologist that are unprofessional or current standard practices, and possibly ARS 32-2061-16-R for possibly failing to obtain a client or patient's informed or written consent to release personal or otherwise confidential information to another party unless released to otherwise authorized by law, and also ARS 2061-DD for possibly violating the ethical standards adopted by the board as it pertains to Section 3.1, informed consent of the American Psychological Association of Ethical Principals and Psychologists for the Code of Conduct. The complaint screening committee asked that Dr. Farr provide the informed consent paperwork and the signed released information. The signed released information was provided, not the form of consent. The doctor has, though, provided to the board that he has developed informed consent forms since the complaint screening committee. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you very much. Ms. Poe, is there anyone requesting to speak other than what you've given me?
No, that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Is the complainant here, and would the complainant like to come forward and make a statement? Complainant is not here.
I don't believe so.
Thank you. Dr. Farr, are you here?
Yes.
And could you step forward to... Please have a seat, and if you could, introduce yourself and counsel. And let's be careful. We speak into the microphones clearly, please.
My name is Dina Anagnopoulos, and I'm Dr. Farr's counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, I'm going to...
Well, please introduce yourself first.
Yes, I'm Dr. Robert Farr.
Thank you, Dr. Farr. Welcome. Thank you for coming. I know these are not the easiest things to come and sit through. Would you like to make a statement, sir?
I would. I have about 5 minutes that I'd like to make a statement. Okay. I love psychology and psychotherapy. It's been my calling in life. I've been fortunate to be married for 51 years to a wonderful, loving, caring, and supportive wife. I moved to Phoenix 7 years ago to retire as well as to help my son and daughter-in-law with my two young grandchildren. I am a two-time cancer survivor and cancer-free for 9 years. I've been in private practice for 37-plus years and since 1982. I've also been a member of the APA since 1982. I'm a member of the National Register of Health Service Providers. I also have my certificate in professional qualification in psychology. After I received my doctorate from St. John's, I immediately began my first of two postdoctoral programs in child and adolescent psychotherapy at the Derna Institute of Advanced Psychological Studies at Delphi University. In 1968, the Institute won a lawsuit against the American Psychiatric Association, which helped establish the rights of psychologists to practice psychotherapy without a medical license. After I completed this 3-year postdoctoral program, I immediately entered the 4-year postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at the Derna Institute and completed that. I also spent 19 years as a psychologist at Pascack Valley Regional High School District, which is in Montvale, New Jersey, where I often function as a crisis intervention person. For 15 of those years, I presented a suicide prevention program each fall for the entire freshman class with the assistance of the guidance department. I have expertise in suicidology. In 1992, I taught second-year clinical psychology students at St. John's University their first practicum in child and adolescent psychotherapy. In 1999, after I retired from the high school, I completed a 2-year certificate program in alcohol and chemical dependency counseling at the Westchester Institute for Training in Psychotherapy. Psychotherapy is ineffective if patients abuse drugs or alcohol. In 2004, I completed a 3-year certificate program at the William Allison White Institute in Child and Adolescent Psychotherapy in Manhattan. This institute was started by Harry Sachs Sullivan, Eric Fromm, and Frieda Fromm Reichman. My focus was to increase my proficiency and skill in play therapy. I have always had a playroom at my office. I apologize to the board for not including the release of information forms as part of the clinical record and not labeling my treatment plan in the clinical record. In terms of informed consent, I have had a professional website for 10 years, and when I call back a potential referral to make an appointment, I encourage perusal of the website because there is considerable information regarding who I am as a psychologist and psychotherapist. My clinical orientation and approaches to psychotherapy as well as issues and conditions that I treat are clearly presented so that the prospective client can make an informed decision as to whether I am the right therapist for him or her. identifying information such as address, phone number, email addresses are enumerated. Fees, billing, contact, and confidentiality were always addressed with new patients during the first few sessions, but were not always documented in the clinical record. Consequently, at your suggestion, I have now included informed consent forms for psychotherapy with adults, children, and couples on my website that can be read and downloaded. All new clients have been instructed to thoroughly read the web pages, but especially the informed consent forms, which they are required to sign and become part of the clinical record when they begin treatment. Also, current patients are being given a copy of the informed consent forms that they are also required to sign. I have also added a client information form to be filled out during the first session, along with HIPAA and perhaps HICVA forms. I have always viewed informed consent as a continuing process throughout therapy. For example, I advise SD that it would be in her best interest to only work with one therapist when she informed me that she had been seeing another therapist simultaneously during the second phase of her treatment. I also discouraged her from seeking out a hypnotherapist. I felt that this might lead to a potential deterioration in her condition. Okay, that's about 5 minutes. So I guess I'll stop on that.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Farr. Do board members have questions for Dr.? Ms. Shreve.
Sorry. Dr. Farr, I was at the complaint screening committee. I just wanted to ask, I think it's the same question that I asked in the meeting. I just want to, you're saying that at the biggest, her complaint was that she had made a comment about not leaving the house, and you said something about gaining weight, and you know, that's what it's like. Did you say anything to that extent?
No, she never made the self-deprecatory remark that you made. You know, and I have a sort of an algorithm when that happens. You know, the preferred response in psychotherapy to such a statement is not disagreement, but certainly not agreement, which is what she said I did. The comment is treated as a matter of exploration. Like, why are you being so hard, harsh, or critical on yourself? Self-deprecatory comments by the patient provide entry for the therapist to begin to explore the basis for such comments. So the goal is to begin to get the patient to feel the inappropriateness of such comments, identify them, and call them out when they occur in the future. She never made that comment, and I never responded the way she said.
And you have now informed consent, as you stated, all of your...
Excuse me?
It's now a requirement for all your patients to sign an informed consent.
Yes, I think I was convinced. I think it's a good idea. I probably, you know, I mean, I had oral, you know, it should be, I read the APA on that, and it says it has to be documented, but it's better if you have a contract. A contractual relationship with your client, you know, and it's good to give that on the phone when they call. This way, you know, they can think about, you know, whether they really want to be seeing me. So I'm very comfortable with that. I'm all for informed consent.
Thank you.
You know.
If I may also make...
Oh, I'm sorry. His attorney's going to make a comment.
Okay.
Thank you. I do want to note that we did submit the 3 informed consent documents that Dr. Farr now uses in his practice, and they are catered towards the specific patients. And in looking at the APA consent rules 10.01, there are certain things that are required in the informed consent, and I do want to make note that all of those are covered in these new informed consent documents.
Thank you.
Just a moment, Dr. Brundage. Dr. Flower was up in line here.
Okay, yes. Thank you for coming again. And indeed, last time when we did the complaint screening committee, we didn't feel that there was substance to the complaint about what she said, and that she said that you didn't give her any tools, but they're clearly documented in your notes. And the draft that I saw in the today's stuff, well, documentation sounds better than stuff. I saw the outpatient services contract and informed consent. And I'm wondering, on the top of it, it just says your letterhead, an outpatient services contract. I wonder if that's been changed to actually put your letterhead on that so it's designed for your practice.
Okay, I can do that. I haven't done that, but I certainly can go to the webpage and do that.
Okay, it's important to do that. It's okay. Not like, I'm not sure it's required in the ethics.
Okay.
But otherwise, it just appears.
You think it would be better?
Well, otherwise, yes. It just appears you found something nice online, which is nice, okay, but to show that you've adopted it, you know, with
okay.
your practice. And indeed, it's great that you have people review the materials, but the signatures and, you know, you co-signing as well is the key documentation, because a lot of people don't read everything online. It's kind of like if you see something about software you want to install and you see a 30-page description of what you're agreeing to, most of us click and pray that it's going to be okay. You know, that informed consent, they may not pay much attention. Hopefully they do. But meeting in person, discussing it, and having them sign and you sign are key. So I'm glad you're making that improvement.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Brundage.
Dr. Bohansky, I have several questions for Dr. Farr.
Go ahead,
Dr.
please.
Dr. Farr, this is Brundage. I was also on part of your complaint screening committee. Hello?
Yeah, we're
yes.
here. Are you great?
I can hear you.
It's made a funny beep. Anyway, several questions. In reviewing the material from ATA and the comments from the complaint screening committee, do you believe that your past consent, informed consent to your previous patients have been adequate?
Well, I believe that I thoroughly had oral informed consent, but I would agree that documentation is necessary according to the rules and regulations of the APA, and I'm going to make sure that happens from now on.
Okay. So you believe you were below the community standard?
I would, I didn't always document informed consent. What do you want to?
Obviously, the informed consent that you've provided to the board on, I believe it was July 17th or June 17th, was very, very different. What have you learned through this process?
Well, I think I've learned that it's probably a good idea to develop a contractual arrangement with my patients regarding the beginning of therapy, and that that the patient agrees to abide by the rules and the documentation, and I think it's very comprehensively spelled out now. I think I would get to that, you know, where if I was working with a patient, we would process information and talk about informed consent if things came up. But I do feel it's better to have a more comprehensive document when you start. I think it just it gets the therapy off to a better point. Now, You know, I've used it. I'm using it with new patients. I've had a few complaints from patients, say, you know, and I mean, the one person who complained, he said, you know, I am a complainer, but this is a lot of things to read and fill out. And I told him, but this is it's for your benefit. And, you know, you really ought to know what is involved in psychotherapy. And, you know, he went along with it. And I think one of his issues is he complains too much.
I must apply both you and your attorney that the current informed consent that you've cover all of the issues, and I thank you for your efforts. I think this certainly is much clearer and much more, even if you may have some complaining patients, you are covered in informing them adequately about your practice. Thank you.
Are there other questions from board members?
Yeah.
Hi, Dr. Milan.
Yeah, my question is, all your current clients, are you going back and getting them to sign it?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Just me. And you probably want to add a line that says witness, or it could be you or somebody else, if you have a, you know, where...
Okay.
I've generally seen that on consent forms, not only the patient signature, but then somebody acknowledging that
right. This
is the person.
I'm going to acknowledge that I am a witness.
Yeah, so you need to add that to the...
Okay, that's a good idea.
Just another comment. If you have a clerk co-sign, that is not cool.
Okay.
Okay, because it's like you have a clerk. Why do they need to go through that? You know, it's best that you do it, as you said. It's just a whole lot better. And then you can answer questions if they have them.
Okay.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Farr. So you'd said that you have conversations with your clients about informed consent, but I didn't see any indication of that in the progress notes. There was no documentation of even a verbal discussion of informed consent. Did I miss that? Or
in the progress notes with SD, there is a note about me speaking to her about the fact that she was seeing another therapist simultaneously, where we discussed that. And you know, and I told her that she's better off choosing one therapist. And she also mentioned something about hypnotherapy. And I said, well, I think traditional psychotherapy would be better for you than hypnotherapy. So those things work. Those are in the clinical record.
But as far as like all of the information that you now have in your written consent form, all of the issues that are a component of informed consent, if you discuss those with your patients,
yes,
there needs to be documentation of that, or it didn't happen.
I know that.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other? I'll just sum up. I'm not concerned about the complaint, doctor. I am also very impressed that you have lengthy and thoughtful notes. The consent to treat or informed consent concept, I think you learn psychotherapy old school like I did. Times have changed. And legal issues have imposed upon us some things we have to do in signing patients up. And from the start, not when it happens to come up in treatment, but from before we start that first session, patients have to be informed and acknowledge they've been informed. And it's really something I agree with Dr. Flower in saying you don't have a clerk do it. It's you've informed them as to the limits of confidentiality and how you proceed. And then we had that HIPAA thing thrown on us, which... there's a Privacy Act thing that people incorporate into that. I think if you've upgraded your records, you have a client sign those, not just say it's available on the internet, but But right, have them sign it in your office on that first session.
Yes.
And it contains those components that we're now required to, not optional, that you'll bring your practice up to what is the current standard. I certainly agree with the suggestion that you sign it at the same time they do, because we have then two signatures at the same date that essentially acknowledges that you've reviewed that with them. And I think that practice will be up to snuff. But these changes occur are not optional, which is, I would encourage you to, on a regular basis, check with our board website, look at our statute and our rules, as well as the current APA practice guidelines. That's just one of those things we all have to do on a routine basis, because things do change over time. You've certainly lived through some of the most substantial changes, as noted, very few of our present-day psychologists recognize it was so recent in time that we obtained the ability to provide psychotherapy. That was a good reminder for us. Thank you very much. If there's no other questions, I would entertain a motion.
Well, since I is my case, I'll be happy to. I don't see any kind of substantiation for the complaint. I think you have updated your conformed complaint, your documents, which we appreciate. So I would make a motion that we drop the complaint. It does not go any further.
Is there a second?
Is that a dismissal?
Dismissal. Thank you.
Second.
And is there any discussion? We have a motion to dismiss.
I'm wondering if a non-disciplinary letter of concern would be more appropriate. Go ahead, Dr. Brundage.
Dr. Brundage?
I was going to make a suggestion that at that point when the complaint was filed, he was under the, I do believe he did not meet the community standard. And at this point, I think a letter of concern would be more appropriate. The licensee has done a nice job of being able to address those issues. Certainly this process, I think, has been very educational for him. But I think that it is important to note that he had not provided that level of expertise at the time.
I'll amend my motion. I would agree with that. That to provide a letter of concern regarding the lack of documentation required.
I would prefer that the motion, because it was a motion to dismiss, now we have a letter of concern. I would ask that the motion to dismiss and the second be recalled, withdrawn.
So I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay, the motion to dismiss is withdrawn. The second is withdrawn. Is there an alternative motion?
I'll make a motion for a letter of concern regarding the lack of documentation.
Non-disciplinary?
Non-disciplinary.
Is there a second?
Can I make a...
Second.
Okay.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion, Dr. Flower.
I'm wondering if we need to specify which violation we're concerned about, or if we can just...
If it's a letter of concern, by definition, there's no violation of statute. It's just noted that the board has a concern about a particular conduct or lack of conduct.
Okay, I think he pretty well knows.
Yeah, but the letter needs to say it. Right.
Yeah, so the letter does not need to spell it out necessarily.
Yes, not the there isn't a violation, so we don't cite anything, but we do say there was a lack of
documentation.
And with the documentation, the
in regards informed to consent. Informed consent.
With respect to informed consent, right.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And would we add language to say that we note that it had been addressed?
Right.
Okay.
You may, if that's a direction that the board would like to note.
So the letter, to me, then, is complete. It includes all the information.
Right. That is identified he wasn't, but then now he has applied informed consent.
Take an action to take care of the documentation of informed consent.
Chairman?
Yes.
Yes. I'll be voting no on this because,
in previous cases, as I recall, we have dismissed them based on Dr. Farr and people like him doing tremendous follow-up to correct it and appearing before the board. So I don't see this being any different than those that we have dismissed that have done major follow-ups.
Thank you, Mr. Donaldson. I'll weigh in. The letter of concern coming about is not about the complaint. It's about our rooting around his records. In doing so, they were old style, and we made some clear recommendations, as did his counsel, that he upgrade his record-keeping system to include what's regularly there and required by our rules as of today. That was done before this hearing. He provided that through counsel to us, which is essentially what we would have expected to have occurred, is that he updated. I agree with Mr. Donaldson that in similar cases in the past, what we have done is thanked the individual for being conscientious and now aware, maybe with a little hand slap saying, stay current. This ain't the 1970s anymore. But you're in compliance now, and we've moved on. Dr. Brundage's point is, had he been practicing for some period of time without a signed consent or HIPAA notice? Yes, he had. And was that up to standard? No, it wasn't up to standard. Has he brought that and all his patients up to standard now? Yes. So what are we concerned about? What he did in the past or what he does in the future? I think letters of concern are not necessarily helpful when they focus on behavior that's already passed under the bridge. So that's kind of where I stand on it. Any other comments? Discussion? No, then I'd like to...
Need a roll call.
We need a call.
A roll call vote. Ms. Poe, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Brundage?
Yes.
Mr. Donaldson?
No.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
No.
We have six yeses and two noes. Motion carries.
Thank you. Doctor, counsel will be informed of our proceedings. Thank you for coming today and participating.
Thank you.
I do want to just make one quick comment. I know Dr. Brundage earlier had commended Dr. Farr and I for the informed consent, and I do want to say that was all Dr. Farr, 100%. He had those to me within days without any comment or anything by me, and that is something that he wanted to, due to the last meeting, something that he wanted to put into his practice. So I commend him for that. I don't deserve any credit for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, see if we can go through a few items. Eight is a timed item. We can go to agenda item number 9, if you would. This is discussion, consideration, possible action regarding adoption of the enhanced examination for professional practice of psychology. Ms. Jones, would you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you bring us up to date with this?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, board members, as you know, the EPPP has been working to develop, the ASPPB, I apologize, has been working to develop the EPPP Part 2, which will be being incorporated into the original EPPP, so it will be at the enhanced EPPP. I've provided some information for you that we received from ASPPB regarding this matter. I also can reach out to Matt Turner. He can be available by phone if you have any specific questions. He is with ASPPB and is the coordinator for this endeavor. So I'd be happy to reach out to him if you have any questions. I know that Dr. Bob has worked on the test. If you're not familiar with developing a high-stakes professional exam, it is a long, tenuous process. The development of the test usually takes years. And the process is you do a job analysis, usually through survey. That's the first step. And then from the job analysis, you must develop a blueprint of what areas you're going to test on the exam. So both of those steps, a lot of outreach to professionals, both current, more recent graduates, older graduates. They grab a section of individuals to survey for that. So then they have the job analysis, they develop the blueprint based on the job analysis, and then they move forward with item development. Item development, again, can take years. It goes through a rigorous role of testing. You have to have all kinds of reference materials for those items. There's usually a study session for people that want to write items. It's not just, oh, we write a question and send it in. It's a very long, drawn-out process. So we're talking years of development, millions of dollars in cost to develop a test. And so all of that back work and background has already been developed in regards to this secondary test. Not secondary, it's an enhanced. It's more of the practical part. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Bob. So they're ready to launch this program. Several states have, I understand, already agreed to do it. And they are looking to Arizona for an answer. And I can reach out to Mr. Turner if you wish to have him available for any questions. I wasn't sure what time we were going to get to the item.
So is this a oral exam then? Because it talks about how it could be based on hours worked, based on whatever the jurisdiction wants.
It's a computer-based.
So it's different questions.
Kind of like an avatar, and meaning you get to, you see a scene and then you respond, So it's more interactive. It's not just paper. It's just not multiple choice. I mean, it is multiple choice, but it's more.
Let me give you the conceptual here. We're the only healthcare profession that doesn't have a competency evaluation. What we have is a general knowledge or fact evaluation. If you were to compare us to the medical profession, they have three parts of their exam. We have two. We have one and three, essentially, conceptually. Part one is knowledge. That's what we do when we approve folks to take the EPPP, is say, do you have the basic knowledge, the core stuff that's there? And then we license people. Medicine says after you do your internship, let's see if you've got some competency or skills, and they provide a test, or part two of their test is a skills test. Psychology was asked to develop a skills test. Over the last 7 years, we've developed a skills test and have now included it with the existing knowledge test, and that's what we're calling the enhanced EPPP. How do you evaluate skills? You get a bunch of the same thing that you heard. You find out what skills are considered important through a job task analysis. You create the validity of that. Then you find out what percentage and how much of that skill and behavior is necessary. You develop a blueprint. Then you develop behavioral exemplars. Then you find the top people in the country who teach that, work in that, practice that. You bring a couple hundred of them together to write items, and you put an exam committee to review those items, and then you spend the next 2 years evaluating those items, and then you might have a test that goes someplace that evaluates both knowledge and then skills. Then after that, you get your license, and then you practice, and then our third part is the specialty board, much like medicine, in which we ABEP. So that's the process, is at the request of Department of Education and many of our colleague boards, the association of our boards has gotten together and developed this. And as it was with the development of a standard test, it comes online slowly as each jurisdiction says, we now define the test as being the enhanced test as opposed to being the old test, just the knowledge one.
What is the cost? Is it an increase in cost?
Yes.
Yes, it is. And if we go with it now, for the next year, whatever, it's like reduced to $100 or something. That was in the fact sheets that are in the item on our sheet. The early adopters get a break in doing this. What's the issues as they come forward? We create a funny period of time for licensing the profession in which some states are going to have the enhanced test in use and some states are going to have the skills only in use and
the
knowledge one only in use. And do we want to be in the lead group, leading the pack with the half dozen or dozen other states that are going to use the enhanced version, or do we want to sit back and wait, because there are several states that are very clearly saying they want to sit back and wait. And each for some of their own reasons. We have an opportunity to create an option at some point, I'm assuming January or June of next year, where we would say now, to be complete, you have to take the enhanced version of this test, not just the knowledge version of this test.
Just so I understand, because I read through this, so they would have to take, if we adopt this, both versions, you would pay, or is it just one test?
Two parts. It's considered one test, but it has two parts.
And the total cost for the whole thing, for parts one and two, would be?
Eventually, over 1,000.
Over 1,000? See, that concerns me. That's a lot of money for that. And then with the new law going through that we accept anyone who's been certified somewhere else for a year, my concern, you know, people go for a year someplace else where it's only the one test and they come here, we'd have to accept them, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of things to consider for the long run. One is, if somebody moves here to Arizona, regardless of, in the past we've accepted whatever exam scores they have, would we grandfather that group to the rest of their psychology career? You know, so if I did an exam in 1971, those scores would be accepted. Would we make them do part two in those cases?
I think that the law that just passed, I thought we have to, if they've had 1 year experience somewhere else in their license, that we, because that's on our agenda too, what is a state resident, you know, then they automatically become licensed in this state.
Mm-hmm.
So whether they took, you know, whatever, if they went to a state, it didn't require both of these.
There will be a funky period of time in which that will all happen. The the issue is that what the future is in our field is an enhanced EPPP. Now, whether it comes on board with 6 states, 8 states, 12 states, 20 states within the next decade, that's my guesstimate, there will be 64 jurisdictions that use the enhanced test. Where are we going to join the parade is the question. Until that, everybody's on, most jurisdictions are going to accept whatever the law was in that state at the time that the person took the test. So we most likely would accept the knowledge test only based upon what our acceptance is at whatever date. And then it will change at some point, in which we're not going to have any mobility for our people when we don't accept it. My question is, when are we willing to jump on board? Do we want to be what they call an early adapter, or do we want to be in the middle of the pack or a late adapter and hold out?
I'm wondering, too, I think I know the answer, but I'll ask anyway because you think you know more than I do. But I know with some, like, software, you're a beta tester. You don't really get credit. You just get experimented with. I would think or hope that if they're a beta, going for the beta time, that whatever tests would count as an EPPP valid test for the future. Is that a correct interpretation?
No.
Okay, how are they used then? I mean, the beta... If we are early adopters, the people wanting licenses when they take it,
yes,
they would pay like $100, which
right.
may at some point be a bargain rate.
It is a bargain rate.
But would it count for their licensure?
Yes.
Okay, so in this state, you'd need 1 and 2 to finish the EPPP.
Correct.
To pass.
In our statute, we'd have to change the statute, right?
Well, that becomes a question for council. Different states have different things written in. I believe our statute says a test as defined by the board. It doesn't name the test. The test owner, which is an association we belong to, is calling this the enhanced EPPP, so that if we chose to use the enhanced EPPP this year, next year, 5 years from now, I don't think we have to change our law. I think we just have to define what the test is that we consider to be the appropriate test for psychologists.
Is it specified in rules, Dr. Bohansky?
No, I don't believe it is.
It's in statute,
if I may, Jean.
Yes.
It's 32-2072. An applicant for licensure must pass the examination for professional practice in psychology, which is the national examination established by the Association of State, Provincial, and Psychology Boards. An applicant is considered to pass the national exam if the score equals or exceeds and I don't have clarification. It says 70% on the written exam or a scaled score of 500 on the computer-based exam. And I've got to clarify the passing point on the new exam. But it is in statute, and it doesn't specifically.
I think the scoring, you know, could be an issue, whether we need to clarify in statute a passing score, you know, the competency part. I don't know how it's going to be scored or if that needs clarification. A substantive policy statement saying that the board defines the examination as the enhanced EPPP could be sufficient, but we may need to address scoring,
a passing score.
They're going to norm it at 500. So.
So each one will have a separate score?
Yes.
I guess I have a couple more questions. One is, if you pass the knowledge but you don't pass the skills, if you retake it, can you just retake the skills?
Yes.
Okay. Or vice versa. If you pass the skills but not the knowledge,
you can't get to the skills without passing the knowledge.
So you have to take them in that order?
In order, yeah.
Okay.
So there's a time between the two?
So it's not done simultaneously?
Correct.
So that could delay the process?
How much time?
Theoretically, it'll speed it up. The hope is that most boards will approve people taking this pre-internship. The knowledge test. They find that, again, much like medicine, when you finish your coursework, you take the knowledge test. And then when you finish your hands-on, your internship, you take the competency test. So they'd essentially take it about the same time they're taking it now. What we do is have people take the knowledge test often several years after they've been out of classes, and that's why we have this whole industry and going back and studying the knowledge questions after they've been practicing for 2 years. This is a tough decision, folks. People are struggling all over the country with this. As you're aware, boards change. People who were sitting on this board 7 years ago are not here. Well, people who were sitting on 64 boards, including the association board 7 years ago, decided to launch into a venture to bring us up to steam or back into compliance with the other healthcare boards and say, hey, here's our competency exam. And 7 years later, it's ready to go. And everybody who thought it was a great idea and voted to spend several million dollars to develop it is now sitting back going, I didn't vote for that. Who the hell did that? Well, it was our predecessors. And they believed it was the appropriate direction to move our profession. Who's they? They is us. And as I would note to you, our former executive director now sits on that board. They're the they that's us, who sits there and says, we've invested in this. We think it's the way the profession should go. And now we have angst among several boards, very vociferously, saying we don't want to do this. Well, the same thing happened when we rolled out the exam we're using now. It actually took 15 years for all of the jurisdictions to use it. Today we sit here the beneficiaries of a standard practice that the boards went through hell to put into effect, in which all 64 jurisdictions now use the same test and the same pass score. If you can imagine, and just over the course of my career, pass scores on that exam varied dramatically from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, as did even whether or not people were using it. So I think this one will be quicker. I don't think it'll be 15 years. The question before us, and this is a window question, it's a window of opportunity, do we jump on the bandwagon? And I'm not asking you to decide today. We could, but when are we going to adopt it? Because, quite frankly, it's going to be adopted by the majority of our colleagues over the next year or several years, and we'll have to make a move. Do we want to be an early adopter is the question, I think, before us today. Not so much are we ever going to be an adopter.
You know, my inclination is that we be an early adopter, because the more people that adopt it early, they're establishing norms and
Correct.
They would contribute to the norms. And if you don't have enough, then you have a smaller, less representative sample. So for the sake of the profession and the, you know, the validity and reliability of a test, the more representative it is, the better it is. And it is going to come to pass?
And that's why, and you make a very good point, it goes back to Dr. Flowers' question, the only way to norm the items is to have people take it for real, frankly.
Yeah, and just take it without...
If you're just taking it for fun and games, which, by the way, we have an offer for anyone here who would like to take it for fun and games... That doesn't go into the norming, but the way you norm, and that's the item analysis, the degree of difficulty on the items for those of you who are statistically inclined, because then each test is made up of a percentage of a certain degree of difficulty of each items, and if you then have multiple forms of the test, you mix the items in proportion to the job task analysis percentage categories, but then they also have to be mixed according to the degree of difficulty. The only way you do that is to collect hundreds of first-time people taking it who took it for real, not for fun, and in which their license was counting on it, and then you can actually come up with that degree of difficulty mix and do the final statistics on it. So that's the phase that they're in right now, and obviously they're very anxious to get a few big states with a lot of people coming on board. I think we only do about 150 a year, something like that, in terms of number of folks. We're not looked at as a big state. We're in the middle with states like Georgia in terms of the number of applicants we have a year, but we're moving in that direction.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Donaldson, please.
Yes, you referenced the EPPP,
mm-hmm.
and it was probably in 15 years. Reminds me of the business I was in. Change is always difficult. But my boss used to say that, yes, and we dragged people kicking and screaming to success. And the thing about adopting something new, in my experience, is, yes, the core of it is very sound, but as more people adopt it, we have a chance to correct it, to make it better, if it needs to be made better. So,
I'll also make an awful statement to you. You've had input into this via me. Yes. I was on the competency committee that turned into, that literally developed what were the competencies we were going to test by doing the job task analysis. And then that took several years, and then they voted at the association to move ahead with an implementation task force. I was on the implementation task force, so I was one of the people that picked the experts, that picked the item writers, that kind of come up with the schemas that you see in front of you as to how to roll that out. Once all of that's established, then there's the final stage, which is what they call the exam committee. The exam committee is made up of an expert from each of the categories tested on the new exam, and they sit twice a year and review what the 100 item writers have come up with to make sure they match both the blueprint and the exemplars and make sense in that category. So I happen to be picked as one of those experts that sits on the exam committee. So Arizona's been represented in each phase of this test development. I'm not personally wed to adopting it today. I am of the belief that it is the future. I agree with Dr. Malott that the early adopters get the most practice and get the most kind of shot at having an impact on how it's going to go, and we don't play catch up. I'm at the end of what's been a 7 or 8 year job, which has met monthly, if you catch my drift. all over this country to do this, and we're finally at the spot where we have turned it over to Pearson View, who's been doing the statistics all along, and said, well, he can do it. The last thing I'll tell you is it does have some multiple choice items, but the majority of it, 80% of it, is what they call technology enhanced items, and that includes, not completely, but includes multiple scenarios in which you build on information from the prior, and some of those are avatars in which you are seeing sessions on the screen occur. So it's a very different thing than just a straightforward multiple choice test.
Sure. Just wanted to make a couple other comments. Unfortunately, I think I was one of the first people in this state to be required to take the ECCC. And I remember the time there was a lot of kicking and screaming, and why do we have to do it, and people before. So I'm sure there'll be resistance, you know, but now I'm able to say, of course I took the ECCC. You know, there was like a sense of confidence that goes with it. Of course, when you're at the beginning stages of your career, you're not thrilled with another challenge. So I can see how this may be a slow process, but in time, I think it will occur.
It will, yeah. No question.
I think
Dr. Meyer had his hand up.
Yeah, so are they setting a certain number of states that need to join as beta testers before it goes live, or could we be the only beta testers?
Oh, we would not. There are half a dozen states already signed up.
They have, okay.
Yeah. What the exact count is changes from week to week,
sure.
So I don't presently know. The last I checked, I think they had 7 states that said when it rolls, it has not come out yet. But then that state, to be licensed in that one of those first states, you'll have to have the enhanced test.
Well, I'll make a motion. I make a motion that we adopt the enhanced examination for professional practices, and then also start moving forward with whatever changes we need to make in our rules or statute to allow us to do that.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Open for discussion. Dr. Myers, please.
One thought is, would it be of value to put this out for discussion for the psychologists in the state? Could we
good point.
Have input from the field?
I'm going to.
Mr. Chairman,
how do I respond to this?
I did present it to the association, let them know that we were going to be talking about it.
Yeah. It's been, there are seminars going on it right now at APA, where there were seminars going on it last year at APA. And there were seminars the year before at APA. It's a bi-nationwide thing. It's been going on at CPA and APA. This would be the test used in both countries. That's how you get to 64, is the provinces, the states, and the territories. It has had opposition from some groups. It's had support from other groups. I'm not going to tell you everybody's waving the flag going, this is wonderful. Who are the groups that have organized against it? There's a group called the Modern Psychologists. Some of us think are terrorists. You can actually go to the website. You'll find my name used in vain and a bunch of other folks used in vain. They have hacked into accounts and gotten email addresses and have been sending stuff to us telling us that we're satanic.
But what about the state? I think the point was his state.
State by state, it's been the topic at the last several state conventions as well. We've had input.
So, Did you want to go?
Oh, I just want to know, we need to put down an implementation date as well.
I think that probably makes sense, too.
And maybe, I'm guessing, letting the schools and the state or whatever know, or I'm not sure how it'd be publicized, but it's kind of like after this date, this will be required.
Yeah, my recommendation would be the beginning of the state fiscal year next year.
So it's 1 July?
July 1 of 2020.
I thought they had a January 20 date in there.
I think they do.
January,
I think
January 1st, 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Dr. Bohansky, I just have one question. If by chance in the beta testing the majority of applicants fail mm-hmm. the test, we don't have a passcode. I'm looking at B in the statute. It says the board may implement an additional exam for all applicants to cover areas of professional ethics and practice consistent with the education experience state law. So this could be considered the additional exam. Mm-hmm. And because it's ethics and practice, and so practice is broad, it doesn't talk about a passcode. So that's my only fear, really, because it's a beta test. And if we have all these people who pass the knowledge exam, you know, I want to be sure that the time is not too long, because we don't want to restrict, because then we're getting into at least for right now, salary issues and things like that.
Let me respond with a couple things. You obviously hire contractors to do some of this stuff, and we hired Pearson View, mm-hmm. which is the largest standardized test folks. These are the ultimate in statistics geeks. They have already projected what the pass rate will be on this. They have already projected the pass scores on this.
So what is? Is it high or low?
The pass rate is ridiculously high. I think the projected pass rate is 92%. The projected pass score, the test will actually be adjusted so the passing score is the same 500 because that's a standard score. It will be a shorter test in terms of number of items, but the standard score will remain the same. You know, whether or not 92% is a discriminatory thing, does it give us adequate discrimination for people that shouldn't practice because they don't have the competency? I'm not sure, and I think that's what we have to look at. But that's what the projections are,
okay.
statistically.
And so a question about that would be, does it just become similar to obtaining reference letters?
Yeah, if it's
everybody
that high.
Passes, it's just another cost and hurdle, yet doesn't actually serve a purpose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the same is true with the medical boards. You have a fascinating concept there.
The one thing I think we should... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I want to...
Just one other... Wouldn't we also have to change our current application process, though, if
yes.
we're looking to do this knowledge prior to internship? Our initial application would also have to change.
Yeah, if we commit to go with this, we then are going to have some more work over this summer and into next year to come up with some of those changes and procedures and applications and what have you. We don't have that as a package with this motion.
So maybe we need to wait then and get a list of everything that needs to be changed.
We can, I think, approve this and then, I don't know.
What is to separate out the motion to approve, and then another motion would be your targeted start date.
Okay, maybe, unless...
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me from a public point of view, adoption of this would possibly improve the quality of psychologists that are being licensed in the state of Arizona. And as a public member, I would view that as us attempting to protect our public from harm from psychologists.
That's our mandate.
That's our mandate. So I think it's, from a public point of view, if it is designed to improve the quality of psychologists, it reminds me of when I was on the school board and we were having difficulty making decisions. This one boarder came up to me, you know, I spent 2 weeks, I couldn't sleep for 2 weeks, and I finally decided that's the reason I elected you, is to make the damn decision.
And I'm sure you made a good one, Joe.
We did.
All right. The motion, as I understand it right now, is just to agree to become an early adopter, and we have other motions that we can make down the road here.
Well, I need to amend it so we have an, if we're going to say early adopter, when it's going to be. Because if we look at the paperwork, this says early adopter is January 1, 2020. I want to make sure that we're clear on what our expectations are for our state. So I would make the motion that we approve the Part 2 skills being part of that. And then do we vote on them separately, Ms. Galvin?
Yeah, the motion would be to approve the enhanced ECPP, not Part 2, but the enhanced ECPP.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, that would be my first, and then the second motion I'll make is that
I'll do one motion at a time.
Yeah, but that we would
there
be...
There a second to the...
Yes, I guess second.
We already
that.
Seconded second. It. We just need a vote.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. And then I make a motion.
Jan, was that an opposition? Dr. Brundage?
No, I agree.
Now there's a second motion coming.
Second motion is that we implement the enhanced version on July 1st, 2020.
Just a thought. If we do need a statutory change.
Yeah.
Maybe later,
like January 1st, 21.
That would give us time to,
yeah, to
look
go
at
the
statutory
statute.
Change, make applications, rule changes.
Let me make a suggestion here. I mean, we don't need to rush into this. I'd like legal advice on really looking at our statute and whether we have to make a change in that. To actually implement this. I've heard it both ways as it's been looked at by external legal counsel, and I'm not clear. So what I'd like to do is hold on the second motion. We said we'd adopt it. We just haven't said when yet, so we are...
But that since we've adopted it, is there a legal thought that now we're in motion with it? I just want to make sure we get a... advice on that.
I missed the question. I'm sorry.
So if we just adopted that we should do this enhanced version by not setting a date, is the idea then that we expect that now?
Well, I think the
consensus. Yeah, I mean, the discussion behind the motion was that there's no deadline.
Okay.
That we need to evaluate whether there's a statutory change.
So that doesn't need to be part of the motion.
No, I think it's
okay.
Fine.
I just wanted to make sure we weren't legally bound to starting right now.
I'd like us to take a break for 10, 15 minutes because then we've got a timed item that we have to get to, and I realize we're pushing the timed item a little bit, but we've had good discussion. We've been going for a bit, so let's recess for a comfort break, please. Start back up here at 10:15.